summertime tips and fun facts from Paul, Kristen, and Dexter at Total Wine & More.
If you're topping off your burger with grilled onions and blue cheese, pair your work of art with a spicy Malbec.
Nothing beats a buttery Chardonnay with grilled corn on the cob. I'm ready to find you the perfect bottle of white for your next get-together.
Pack up the cooler for this weekend. We've got canned wine and beer ready to throw on ice.
Now with 9 locations in the Bay Area. Visit our newest store at Stevens Creek Central. Shop online at TotalWine.com. The selection is ridiculous. Cheers.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rusland, today we have BFM's very own Uma Pagan, Ambike Pagan.
Hello, Cam.
And we have the return of, after a very long time, the British Council's man in Kuala Lumpur and patron, Grey Yeo.
Oh, it's good to be back after a long time.
You've been away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which we'll probably hear about.
Yeah.
And so our three topics this week will be, topic number one is Kendall Jenner saves the world in a Pepsi ad. Topic number two is patronage of the arts. And finally, topic number three is comics and propaganda. So with topic number one, you must have seen it by now, folks. And if you haven't, you've got to watch it. It's a TV commercial that was shown in America featuring Kendall Jenner, the pretty socialite...
brunette Kardashian.
Yeah. Half Kardashian.
Half Kardashian, sorry.
And it's an absolutely tone-deaf advert where she is at the beginning of... There's some sort of like demonstration happening on the streets. Lots of pretty young people are demonstrating about something. We don't know what. We don't know where. Mm-hmm. But they're holding up signs that are saying, join the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what they're demonstrating about. And then she's doing a fashion ad, a photo shoot right there, and she sees the crowd. She, in fact, catches the eye of this Asian-looking fellow who happens to be demonstrating whilst carrying a cello.
Mm-hmm.
And she joins the crowd. It leads to a police line, a very benign-looking bunch of policemen. And, in fact, they're so benign, I'm pretty sure they're actually male strippers. And their uniforms are being held together with Velcro. And then she walks up to them and hands them a can of Pepsi.
That's right.
And she saves the day.
Yes. The policemen look at each other and smile, and they crack open the can of Pepsi.
Right.
Mm. You have to consume the product first. Product placement. Very important.
That's right.
So it's a terrible advert, and they showed it very briefly in America, and then they pulled it almost immediately with lots of apologies, saying, we're terribly sorry, we don't know how we got this one so wrong. But I would posit, though, that PepsiCo are a big company, that the soda market in the US is so huge, it's probably bigger than the entire Malaysian economy, and they would have done their research, and they must have judged that there is a shift amongst young people toward political activism,
mm-hmm.
and you know, looking at demonstrations as being a good thing that they would like to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
It's just though that the young people who do take part in these would be demonstrating against precisely the sort of company that PepsiCo is.
Well, you say that, but I have a solution to this ad. I can fix it.
Okay.
Just remove Jenner, Kendall Jenner,
mm-hmm.
replace it with Beyonce, and it's fixed.
Why?
It really is. I think it's because it's tone deaf with a privileged elite white person who is somehow walking into this protest that is supposed to, sure, they're all good looking, but that is supposed to be symbolic of the underclass of society, or the hipsters of society, if you will, in this case. And somehow she's the one who walks up and goes, here, have a Pepsi and everything's okay. Yet again, white savior complex, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm not sure about that because I think... I get what you mean,
yeah.
But I think there's still a lot of issues and a lot of problems within the ad itself, you know?
Oh, no, for sure.
The sort of generic protest, we're not sure what they're protesting about.
Correct.
I think it's for the rights of pretty people, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, they're not pretty enough.
Yeah.
Life is still too hard for them. But also, I think from my lens, I thought there were a lot of tokenistic things that were inserted into the ad, you know? You have your... Asian, the cello player, the cellist.
Asian, right?
Yeah, ambiguous
Asian.
Asian
with darker skin.
You had a woman who's a photographer who's wearing the hijab.
Correct.
And you have a couple of transgendered looking, maybe they are transgender persons, you know, hugging each other. And then you have a kind of generic looking young crowd that, you know, seemingly is marching against something that we don't know what.
Maybe they're not actually going to a demonstration, but they're leaving a nightclub very early in the morning.
It could be. Yeah. I mean, I think
and they're asking,
sat down,
you know, people to join the conversation.
To tell us where we're going. Yeah. What time is it?
Well, they sat down in a room and they ticked off the diversity list, yeah. Right?
So I have an issue with that because it becomes a tick box exercise, but also at the same time, I think there may be a kind of tunnel vision in the maybe advertising, you know, the creative team's execution of it where we really need to look at diversity. We need to look at sexuality, gender. We need to look at race. We need to look at da-da-da-da. But no one in the hierarchy actually looks at the bigger picture and says, actually, guys, you know, I mean, how many levels does it take for someone to point it out and say this ad is really tone deaf?
No, but also, I don't even know why they bother going with protests because there's no major corporation the size of Pepsi or Coca-Cola or McDonald's is actually going to depict a protest with something tangible behind it because they're not going to want to alienate anyone of their consuming masses, right? So that's why they try to keep it as ambiguous as possible. And but that comes off as offensive.
Yeah, and also it's set. It's not in America. I mean, the police uniforms are not American uniforms.
No, they're, yet again, they're generic dictatorial country uniforms. Yeah,
well, I do believe it's Kardashian. I think it's the land of Kardashian.
Oh, my God, that should be a place.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so it's a terrible bad because the people perhaps they're trying to appeal to, if they want soda, then they would want it made artisanal soda from, like, the Seattle Fiddler Brothers organic soda.
No, but
company.
You see where they're coming from, right? I mean, a decade ago, a decade and a half ago, Coca-Cola would do a similar ad. They would do an ad where, you know, Coke is love or Coke brings people together. Mm. I mean, that was the message, right?
Yeah.
Warring factions, West Side Story, Coke will bring them together.
Yeah.
But I think in this current political environment as well, with everything that's going on in America especially, that's where, for me, the massive tone deafness lies, right? Mm. Are you unaware of everything that's happening outside your building that you would put this out there?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Correct.
Perfect. Back in the 60s, really hippie, and they really got it right. It really
yes.
did, you know, fit the times, but this is just dreadful. But anyway, if you haven't seen it, folks, you just got to look it up. It's so bad. It's not just OMG bad. It's OMFG bad. Mm. And
it's
so
one conversation about Kendall Jenner, and he's like down with the slang and everything.
That's right. But I would say it's the difference between DC and Marvel.
Oh.
Yeah, I think I know what I mean. So, topic number two, Gray, you've been traveling for quite some time now.
Yeah.
And you have seen some things, including patronage of the arts.
Yeah, I think maybe I can frame the topic patronage of the arts. While I spent some months in Australia down under, I visited Tasmania. And of course, people who have been to Tasmania in the last few years, maybe 3 or 4 years, they would definitely be familiar with the Museum of Old and New Art, MONA. This museum is started by this really rich Tasmanian. He's a millionaire. His name is David Walsh. He's put his money into a collection of art, and MONA itself has about 400 art pieces, you know, from artifacts to digital art to ancient sphinx, you know, across the spectrum of what you consider art. And it struck me because this guy, this one person who's made his money, obviously through various things that he does, but he maybe
gambling,
made his...
Through gambling.
But he's decided to put the money into, you know, art and making MONA the number one tourist destination in Tasmania. It that institution itself changed the scene and changed how Tasmania is seen by the world. And it was fascinating because I spent hours in MONA, besides fascinated by his collection, his private collection, just thinking about how this one person, you know, changed the landscape of the arts in Tasmania.
Yeah.
So I started thinking and comparing it to philanthropists or patrons in the arts in Malaysia and found that we have very, very little of...
Very few.
Whether it's private individuals who are giving money to the arts or you know, just being a patron for, say, a theatre company or dance company of a visual artist, for example.
Yeah.
So it's very little. And started thinking about whether this idea of patronage is so alien in Malaysia, that's why we don't have them,
yeah.
Or is any other factors involved?
Yeah. It must be that, I think. But also maybe not wishing to stand up to advertise your money, I think, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe there's the whole Asian humility sort of things. But when you think about the other way, I still think that it can be quite humbling for you to be giving your money to art.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
Because I am deeply disappointed by how rich Malaysians, by and large, simply just don't take part. Are not patrons of the arts.
And so does that go back to this cultural baggage that we have about lineage and inheritance, in that rich, like super rich families, it doesn't matter if you're Chinese, Indian or Malay, there is this notion that you have to hand it down to your next generation, that you have to give it to your children. And, you know, that's something that seems very ingrained, or even the children seem to think they're entitled to it. Right.
Yeah, but I'm talking about people who are like seriously rich, for whom, you know, giving away 50,000, say, to
is pocket change, right? Yeah.
Pocket change. I mean, that's not going to break the lineage. The situation I've come across, though, is more that rich people need to see that government is pursuing this first, because they're too afraid to do something that government isn't doing.
I mean, sure, yeah. I mean, the philanthropy industry in Australia, in the US, is huge, you know, where there are mechanisms allow for tax relief, for example, or some kind of incentives for rich people to continue giving to the arts.
Yeah, there is that.
And also, I think arts organizations or museums, galleries in those countries, they are also very savvy when it comes to fundraising. So they have mechanisms, they have packages where they can offer to philanthropists how big or small the amount, where you are able to then get, you know, benefit package A, benefit package B, you're a lifetime member, VIP or whatever.
Okay, then how much of it has to do with value then, Gray? Because even with the benefits and so on and so forth and tax relief or whatever, how much of it is that our society maybe doesn't see value in the arts?
Yeah, so that's also one of the questions that need to be asked. And whether it's a society as a whole that does not see that, whether, you know, it's, again, through education system, whether we teach our young people to see art is more than just entertainment.
Yeah.
It can be life-changing.
Because it isn't to say that we're not charitable. We are very charitable.
Yeah, yeah.
We give to the poor, we give to help the ailing, all that stuff we do.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we also have examples of Malaysians who have been giving to the arts, or have their own foundations that give to the arts. The Al Bukhari Foundation and the Islamic Arts Museum, for example.
Yeah.
Great, great example.
That's a very good museum. Yeah.
But one of the few...
It's a handful, right?
Yeah. I mean, per capita, rich people per capita in this country, it's awful. It's really poor. Because, yes, so the arts are considered to be frivolous and middle class and an add-on. But it's not like I see people then giving money to sports or, you know, health activities or to... I know you're saying people are generous, but that's like middle class, working class generosity. That's individuals putting up a few hundred, whatever they can. Mm. But the people who've really got money to give away... I know.
But, you know,
they got great property in London.
Yeah, and also I think there are occasional examples that we can see. I remember a few years ago there was it's one of those, you can see it from the lens of privilege and you can see it from a lens of super upper class appreciation or consumption of art. When Bukit Bintang Road was closed down because of a concert by the Three Tenors or Andrea Bocelli or whatever, I can't remember. And that was orchestrated by YTL. So there are things like that. And, you know, YTL have given a lot to, say, the KL Pack Joe and Farida. And, you know, there are examples, there are good examples like that in Malaysia.
Yeah.
I think the corporations, you're right as well. Yeah. Even Saim Darby, lots of corporate Petronas, all of these people, they
collect Malaysian visual arts, you know.
Exactly.
If you look at visual artists in Malaysia, most of them are collected by corporations, Malaysian corporations.
But I think I agree with the point that Cam is trying to make as well, which is that, yes, Saim Darby, Petronas, YTL are three examples of the biggest corporations in Malaysia, right? Possibly even Southeast Asia. So I think Cam's trying to make the point that there are people of maybe even a few rungs lower than that, but who are still uber rich. Mm. But for some reason, there isn't that cultural indoctrination among our people that the art theatre, film, literature is museums, something crucial and important to society.
Yeah.
And, you know, people need a museum. They need places to go to.
Yeah.
And people have to give money to make that happen.
Yeah, so when I go and visit museums across, you know, say the UK, Australia, wherever I go, I tend to, the first thing I beeline for is museums. And there are usually the kind of...
plaque.
The plaque big and plaque the with, list of names of the donors and all
individuals
that.
Individuals,
yeah, it's huge and it's
and
like
I love looking at those.
Never ending.
Yeah, I love looking at those.
And the corporations
I take photographs
are
of them.
Yeah.
Actually, but here we don't have that.
We don't have to go so far. There are massive plaques in Singapore.
Singapore, absolutely. Yes. So I can think of one example in Penang, for instance, when Suffolk House was done. But it makes me so angry that I am tempted to grab a can of soda, take to the streets...
And just give it to a policeman.
Yeah, give it to a policeman and say, join the conversation.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there you are. Rich people, if you're listening, get your act together. So in a moment, though, we will have topic number three here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Uma Pagan, Amike Pagan, and Grey Yo. And now, topic number three, propaganda and comics.
Yes, so a big story broke over the weekend in the comics world, which was very tied into us because it's really close to home. A comic book artist by the name of Ardian Syaf, out of Indonesia, and he was commissioned to write the first four or five issues of a brand new X-Men comic. Marvel Comics are relaunching all of the X-Men series, so it's a big deal for Marvel. So it turns out that the first issue of this comic that was released on Wednesday had hidden references to the Ahok protest in Indonesia.
In Jakarta.
Yeah, so anti-Ahok protest. So, as you know, the protest kind of took on a life of its own because it became a anti-Christian, Muslim versus Christian type thing, and the artist was against Ahok. And in a couple of these panels of the comic book, there's one character by the name of Colossus, and he's wearing a t-shirt that says QS 551 or Quran Surah 551, and that was the thing they were chanting. It's a verse in the Quran that is often translated to mean, friends, do not take Christians and Jews as your friends.
Because, it should be just said, that Ahok, Mr. Ahok, he is running to become the governor of Jakarta.
Yes.
And he is of ethnic Chinese background and a Christian.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's debates as to what that surah translates as. Some people don't say that it translates as this, but the wide belief and understanding is that it's an Islamist and anti-Semitic verse, right? And so, of course, huge outcry, because... made doubly worse by the fact that the X-Men comic is one huge metaphor for minority rights, right? Because they're mutants that are being oppressed by humans, etc., etc. And so to have an anti-liberal message in this comic book, the internet outcry was huge. Marvel Comics acknowledged it. They promised to take action. And for all practical purposes, Ardian Syaf's career in comics is essentially over, right? I don't think any major... U.S. comic publisher will touch him now because if you're being as soon in America, as soon as you're being associated with being Islamist or anti-Semitic in any way, whatever your intentions were, you're dead, right? So I want to talk to you today about this because I think comics is a very interesting medium for propaganda and has always been throughout the years. One, because of its just wide appeal. It doesn't just appeal to kids; it appeals to adults, and it's a way to get really subtle messages out there to the youngest members of our society.
It should be pointed out, though, that the Indonesian, he's an illustrator. He was just illustrating the piece. He was not writing the piece.
Yeah, so correct. So how the industry kind of works is, there's a writer and there's an artist, and the writer will usually send the artist the scripts, and both have a certain amount of independence. Some writers are very specific, and they will have descriptions of what every panel should contain, and some writers are very open and they will say, this character is just saying this, you fill in the background, they're in the middle of a street at a protest or whatever, and then you just kind of fill in the details and stuff, and that's what he's
done. But Uma, you I thought it's so sweet of you, Uma, by the way. It's big news in the comic world. You grew up with comics.
I did.
So do you think that you were, whilst growing up, impressed subliminally by propaganda or
so
whatever?
I think there are certain comics that stand out in my mind. There was, back in the day, there was one particular issue of Spider-Man. It was a two-parter, which was just about gun crime in America and how it just destroys the youth. And I remember, for me, that was my earliest exposure to, like, the gun problem. But it was done through the lens of Spider-Man and this kid on the street who bought a gun in school. and stuff like that. And, you know, I think it's a very interesting introduction to the politics of what's going on in America in that situation. But, you know, closer to home, you know, if you read Gilla Gilla magazines as well, that was very subtle, subversive stuff. Sure, which I only realized when I was a grown-up, but I read it as a kid, and I don't know how much that played on my subconscious.
Yeah. Gray, what about you? Did you?
I can't tell it because I'm not a huge comic fan. I read comics as a side when my friends are, you know, all into it. And I was like, okay, yeah, it's kind of cool. But I think it does have, I mean, one of the most impressionable comic for me is Kingdom Come, where it talks about, you know, all these superheroes and they were fighting each other. And that was really, really huge. And it was on the backdrop of, you know, nuclear and atom bombs and how do you, you know, work that out. So in a way, it does talk a little bit about, you know, the dangers of how, you know, your person can change because of the larger circumstances. But I wanted to say that, you know, how subtle these propaganda messages are versus how quite blatant some comics can be. We all know about I think it was, Uma, you'll know this, Superman did some series when it was World War II, I think. There were some that were really, really blatant about how Superman
was. He was like punching out Hitler, along with Captain America. Everyone was just fighting the Nazis.
Yeah, so these are really, really blatant.
Taking a stand, right?
Yeah, taking a stand. Versus like this example that you have where it's just one small image. And as there was another panel that says 212, a number 212.
Second of December.
Which was the date of the huge protest. So, involving like 2 million people.
So it's interesting because I think the reaction from people who read into these and recognized these propaganda messages.
Yeah, because you're not going to be like, you know, see the panel without knowing it and just sort of like find yourself zombie-like walking towards, you know. But I would say, again, I didn't grow up with comics, but cartoons. And I cannot help but remember Scooby-Doo. And how, as a young person, even then...
Encourage marijuana use?
Well, no, kind of. I mean, the gang in Scooby-Doo were very peculiar. And I think that they introduced Shaggy. Shaggy is this... I mean, what is he? He's a dope-smoking... Well, I mean,
he doesn't smoke dope, but he sounds like it, right?
Yeah, and then there's this rather mannish girl.
Velma,
there's the cute... And then... Just the relationships. Who are these people somehow related? Are they sleeping with each other? What's going on?
They all live in a van.
They all live in a van. And so growing up for me, I think I was actually quite intrigued by gender roles or something by watching that.
But I think the messaging is important in these books because a lot of time people write off comics as being disposable, but I think artists
not
and writers
here.
Not in this room, but I think artists and writers actually use the medium. I mean, hidden messages in comics is nothing new, right? Artists have hidden messages for generations only to be found out decades later. There's this one artist, I think his name was Skyver, literally without exaggeration, on every page of the X-Men series that he wrote, there will be some hidden word that's spelled sex. Just for kicks, right? Uh-huh. There are lots of these hidden sexual innuendos in comic books that writers just throw in and artists just throw in for kicks, right?
Yeah.
But when the political messages come across, I think the medium is actually a really potent one because audience, no one in America is going to notice any of this. Right?
Yeah.
It was his Indonesian audience that he was targeting because he thought he could slip it in and he was making his political stand clear. I disagree with his political stand, but for fans of the anti-AHOK movement, then those are the people he wanted to talk to. And he thought he could slip it in. Take another example. I was in Singapore over the weekend. I found a great book called A Boy Named Harry. And it's a children's book about Harry Lee Kuan Yew. And it's partial comic, partial children's text. But every page is almost beautifully crafted to put across that Singapore message, that Singapore propaganda, right? And I'm going to read you something, and it's going to immediately hit you in the face, but I think you'll get where I'm coming from. So this is later in the book, and Harry Lee Kuan Yew has gone to Raffles Institute. Uh-huh. For all the prizes he won at school, there was one thing that Harry would never receive an award for: getting to school on time. He could never wake up early and was often late for school. The rule at RI, Raffles Institute, was that anyone late for school 3 times in one term would get 3 strokes of the cane. This happened once to Harry, and he was sent to the principal, D.W. McLeod. Mr. McLeod knew Harry was a very good student, but that didn't mean that Harry wouldn't be punished. Bent over a chair, Harry was given 3 hard strokes of the cane. I mean, that is the Singapore message, isn't it? No matter how many prizes you've won, no matter how good you are, if you mess up, we will punish you for it.
Did Harry learn his lesson, though?
It didn't say whether Harry was late
ever again.
But the next page goes on to say that Harry once again came top of his class.
Did he?
Yes, he did. God, and not just top of his class, but top of all the students in Malaya and Singapore.
No.
There you go.
Wow, he's amazing.
He also mixes well with his Malay and Chinese neighbours and speaks multiple languages.
Oh, wow. he should be a prime minister.
But if you give it to children, you know, and that is the kind of Singapore message that they want to get out there. You want to be like Harry Lee Kuan Yew. He is the perfect Singaporean.
And there are several, there are going to be several books
in this series.
Oh, several
editions. I think they're all out now. It's first one's called A Boy Named Harry. Second one is called Harry Grows Up, and I think that's him going to medical school and all that stuff. And then the third one is my favourite, Harry Builds a Nation.
Wow. I like that one.
When I grow up, I want to be Harry.
Yeah. What about like Harry and the Goths, or
I think that's
Harry
coming
the
soon.
Gaul?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Harry in Britain.
Harry versus Sasquatch. You know, that's all coming soon. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it lifts this character, this very real person who already gets hero worship in Singapore, to this iconic legendary status of, like, you know, I can't find a copy of it, but I've heard in the past there was a Lee Kuan Yew superhero comic. No. Where Lee Kuan Yew was the superhero.
Wow.
But I haven't found it yet. I need to get myself a copy of that. But
okay.
So this one is actually targeted to the younger generations who've never knew him.
Exactly. Yeah. Because that's if true, you were 5, 6, 7 years old, he's not in your consciousness. But you know what? Harry built a nation.
Didn't we have one as well in Malaysia where there was a comic or something that was about our Prime Minister too?
Oh, there was. But that was actually issued by our Prime Minister's office. It was the Super Najib as the ultimate transformer.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
That's right. I haven't got my hands on a copy of that, though. But you can Google that and you can find images of it online.
Mind blown.
There you go. Right. There you go.
So,
all these young terms that you're using, Cam.
It's the way I am. It's the way I am. Deal with it. Yo. So, anyway, we must move on, though, to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. As me first, no. So I got 2 quick things to recommend. One is producer Ali and I were discussing this fabulous Indonesian band that we've seen clips of, a couple of clips, on the internet. They're called VOB, and they're 3 16-year-old girls. They look tiny, but they really can play. The bassist, in particular, is spectacular. Should I also add that they wear tudung and it's really heavy metal kind of sound, but very accomplished. So I check it out. VOB.
VOB.
I'm not quite sure. The Dutch East India Company, their initials were VOC. So maybe VOB. I don't know. But my other recommendation, my real recommendation, is there's this very good TV series on at the moment called The Feud. It's a multi-part thing depicting the feud between...
The real-life feud.
The real-life feud of the actresses Joan Crawford and Betty Davis.
That's right.
Back in the 60s. But these two actresses were huge in the 1940s.
And it's played by...
Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon.
Yeah.
And it's a multi-part. I've actually seen just 2 episodes out of sequence, but it's so good.
Is it good?
Oh, it's really good. It's done by the same... cable channel that did Mad Men, and it shares a lot in common with Mad Men. I just thought it would be this sort of like this, I don't know, bitch fest, you know, people just sort of like screaming at each other and saying catty things, but it's so much more than that. It's really about women, it's about aging, it's about men trying to leave a legacy, ambition. It's very, very good.
I've seen the trailers for it, and Susan Sarandon looks really good in it.
Yeah, she actually looks and sounds like Betty Davis.
Fantastic. I need to check that out. It's been on my list.
Yeah, it's very good.
It's just too much to watch.
Yeah. And so, great. Go second.
Okay, so I'm going to recommend that everyone kind of go check out museums in KL, in Malaysia, if you can. Museums and maybe galleries. I think because they don't receive enough visitorships. And I may be talking to, you know, preaching to the converted, you know, people who listen to a bit of culture. But I think, you know, go and visit the Islamic Arts Museum, go and visit Ilham Gallery, go and find, you know, Balai, our own Balai. just go and visit, and then you can see actually what we've been talking about. You know, art in Malaysia is good. It deserves more visitorship.
What's a good museum? I think that the Islamic Art Museum
Islamic
is
art
probably
museum is
our
good.
Best one.
Probably
I think.
The best. Yeah. Yeah, it's very plush, very, very beautifully done. Some great pieces in there.
There's a few good shows.
I haven't
shows.
Been to our National Museum in a long time.
Yeah, I was
but I
say.
Know there's a group that organizes tours of the National Museum. It's privately organized, and they have tour guides that do it in multiple languages as well, not just English, BM, Tamil, and Mandarin or Cantonese, but other languages like German and Japanese. They get volunteers to come and do it. So it's worth going and checking out what our National Museum is like these days.
Yeah, and the contemporary collection in contemporary art collection there is really, really good. Yeah. So yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah.
Really
yeah.
worth.
And I do believe it's due for quite an overhaul soon. Actually, maybe something might be happening there. Okay, so go visit museums. I'm with you there. Mm-hmm. Yo. And so, Uma.
Yes, so I've got a museum recommendation as well. If you happen to find yourself in Singapore at any point, when I was there this last weekend, I went to the Art Science Museum, and they often have great exhibitions, but there is a new exhibition called The Universe and Art. And essentially, it is how man's gazing out into the heavens and exploration into space and how it's influenced art and our depictions of it. And everything from literature to visual art to photography to even sculpture and installations, they take you through different rooms which kind of cater towards different. So, you know, it starts off with like ancient Hindu, Buddhist, Jain representations. It takes you into Japan. They've got great texts. They've got the first edition of Galileo. They've got a first edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species, all under glass and sealed and all that stuff. But it was just beautiful to see, like, the work by Nicholas Copernicus right there in front of you, which is amazing. And literally throughout walking through this exhibition, my hair was standing on end the whole time, just because you are in the presence of such incredible history, and also top that off with the mystery and vastness of space and all of that stuff. It's like double inspiration in your face.
So that's the Art Science Museum.
It's called Art Science Museum, which is attached to the Marina Bay Sands. Actually, speaking of patronage, there you go. Casinos, putting lots of money in art and museums.
Is it a temporary traveling exhibition, that one?
Yes, it's not a permanent exhibition.
Oh, okay.
But it literally just started on April the 2nd, I believe, or April the 1st. These things usually run for about 3 months, but I cannot recommend it highly enough. If only because I think that's the only time you will be so close to some of the greatest artifacts and objects of history that influence our understanding of the universe. Go check it out.
That out. But also the art science. Great.
Yeah.
That sounds very interesting. And I will go check out the exchange rate at the moment for Sing Dollar.
Oh, it's very painful. Very painful.
Yes. So, that brings us to the end of the show. Only remains for me now to thank special honored guests. Welcome back, Gray Yeo.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Good. And Uma Pagan, I'm K. Parker.
Always a pleasure, Cam.
And myself, Cam Rustin. You can get in touch with us through our Facebook page. Every like saves a puppy.
And Angel gets his wings.
Angel gets his wings. And yes, so please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Summertime tips and fun facts from Paul, Kristen, and Dexter at Total Wine & More.
If you're topping off your burger with grilled onions and blue cheese, pair your work of art with a spicy Malbec.
Nothing beats a buttery Chardonnay with grilled corn on the cob. I'm ready to find you the perfect bottle of white for your next get-together.
Pack up the cooler for this weekend. We've got canned wine and beer ready to throw on ice.
Now with 9 locations in the Bay Area. Visit our newest store at Stevens Creek Central. Shop online at TotalWine.com. The selection is ridiculous. Cheers!